If you're interested in issues like income inequality or other things pertaining to social justice, then you probably know the name Barbara Ehrenreich. She spent her life searching for answers. She's written nearly 24 books about things like poverty and underemployment, including the bestseller Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. But her latest book is about searching for answers within herself. The book is titled Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. And Barbara Ehrenreich is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Oh, glad to be with you.
You said you didn't want to write a memoir or an autobiography.
No.
How would you describe it?
All right. Here's my, biggest promotional thing to say about it. I like to think of it as a little bit of a metaphysical thriller. I start with a question. As a child, I start with a question, what's going on here? Why are people born and then go through all this stuff and then die? What's this all about? And that question, one way or another, motivates me all the way through some very strange events.
I want to get you to tell us about some of those strange events, but you describe yourself as a fourth-generation atheist.
Yep.
And I wanted to ask if you would just set it up by telling us, why are you a fourth-generation atheist? How did it happen coming from
a
Irish
Catholic
background?
I'll tell you the family story, right?
Uh-huh.
From my father. These are people who were mostly copper miners, railroad workers, the men in my family, in western Montana, in Butte, Montana. And my father had a grandmother, possibly a great-grandmother. When her father lay dying, she sent for a priest to administer the last rites. She got back a message that the priest wouldn't come unless she could pay him $25, which was completely beyond them. So that was the end, really, for my family. A couple of years later, she lay dying herself, a young woman in childbirth, and the priest showed up. And he hadn't been asked, but he showed up. There was a crucifix placed on her chest for the last rites. And according to my father, with her dying breath, she grabbed that crucifix and threw it across the floor. Now, that's a heavy legacy. You know, you don't betray that.
And it was also, but you also describe it as both a kind of a suspicion of all authority, you know, that you
yes.
kind of inherited of, you know, bosses,
lawyers,
priests of lawyers, a government of like
doctor,
suspicions
yeah.
of all kind of authority. But I did want to ask if you wouldn't mind reading a passage from the book about how you grew up.
It wasn't easy being a child atheist during the Great Cold War, or for that matter, probably any time in human history outside of a few short-lived communist states. At school, I tried to blend in by mouthing the Lord's Prayer along with everyone else, which was mandatory in those days in the public schools, only sometimes permitting myself to slip into inaudible mocking gibberish. But I could not hide my peculiarity on Wednesday afternoons, when all the other kids were bussed off to what was called religious study at various churches, while I remained behind at my desk under the grudging supervision of a teacher who might otherwise have been free to leave. There were times when I was taunted after school for being a, quote, communist, which I understood only as a derogatory term for atheist. Once some boys picked up rocks and chased me home, but I outran them. How would I have turned out if I had not been set apart by this irreconcilable difference? If when I had first started asking why, I had been given that great non-answer, God. I like to think that I would not have been satisfied and would have persisted, taking my question why right up to him. But then again, maybe I would have ended up as some denatured version of myself, content with whatever anodyne explanation was being handed out.
As you describe it, you've been on a quest for why ever since. I mean, you started with science. Your father, for example, who through scholarships was able to kind of get out of the mines, and you were interested in science yourself. You've been a science writer, too. And you also talk about you're kind of interested in other religions. But why do you think the why is so important to you? Always was.
It's not only why. It could also be put as what is going on. You know, what is the situation that we are in? I can't explain it. That's just burns in me. And it can take me to science. It could take me to the study of history, religion, of anthropology, whatever.
You describe something in the book, and one of the pleasures of the book is revealing what this experience is that has also been something you have not talked about, written about recently. You call it altered states of consciousness. Other people have called these kind of spiritual experiences. Do you want to talk about that?
I don't like the word spiritual. I'll just say that.
I would say other people call it that.
I don't know. You know, it started when I was 13 and came to a sort of a climax when I was 17 in an experience that I much later learned had a term, and that is that it was a mystical experience. I don't think that's a great phrase, but it's the best I can do. I didn't know at the time that it had ever happened to anybody else. Now I think it's fairly common. But I will say I was outdoors, very overtired, etc. Suddenly the world flamed into life. It's like something was rushing at me from all directions. It was beautiful and it was terrifying. It gave me a feeling of completion and a feeling of being shattered. That's the best, almost the best I can do in decades of trying to find some words.
And you describe this in the book, that there are people who have psychological explanations for this. You find those unsatisfying?
No, I lay out here plenty of possible clues or whatever explanations you could say. Childhood difficulties. I was very solitary, introverted, thoughtful kid. You could talk about various physical and chemical changes in the brain and so forth. I'm down with that. That's fine. But here's the subjective experience. That's what I deal with. And, you know, I didn't dare think this, but I sort of guessed it. It seemed like an encounter with something or someone or some being other than myself. Now, I was an atheist, so I couldn't slap the word God on that and be done with it.
It is a bit of a mystery story. It's a kind of an investigative, what's the word that you used at the beginning of our conversation?
Metaphysical thriller.
A thriller. It is a thriller because you describe kind of your process of trying to investigate this, but also the fact that you, as a very young girl, had kind of written about this to yourself and put that away, you know, through all of your moves, through all of your other books, and have talked about many hard things that a lot of people don't talk about. But somehow you didn't want to talk about this, and I'm wondering why.
I did not want to appear insane. And I'm still afraid of that because, you know, all my life, I never said a word about this. Not to the people closest to me, because it sounds too crazy. That's how I thought. And that when I was a teenager, I thought, well, what is this? Is it schizophrenia? Is it, what's going on here? I was afraid of being diagnosed and put into psychiatric care somewhere.
How do you feel now? Now that you've written about it and we're now talking about it?
Well, this is a huge leap. This really took a lot of courage from my part to do this, which may seem silly. But here's what's happening. I'm beginning to hear from people I know very well, saying, my God, that happened to me too. Sorry for the God in that sentence. But I know what you're talking about. We never talk about these things. Now, you give me something that we, quote, never talk about, and I want to start a conversation about it.
How are you with the God idea now?
I'm an atheist. No, this has nothing to do with people's ideas of God, which in our time and culture are mostly of a monotheistic, benevolent God.
Or a judgmental God.
Or judgmental, whatever.
But omnipresent, all-knowing.
But that assumes something so human-like. I think, as I have studied, and I have studied some of the Christian mystics in preparing to write this book, and I'm not a Christian, they describe often an experience not unlike mine. It's not about good or evil.
So why do you call your book Living with a Wild God? Is God just the best name for what you experienced?
Yeah, I guess I'm pandering to the fundamentalist more. No, I'm not kidding. I'm only kidding. No, I just liked that concept. If you could get people away from thinking of God as this person-like creature who is moral. Morality is a human thing. And some animals, I would say, too. But get away from that completely. think of something wild, something that we really don't have the terms and the categories to understand.
Why does one have to get away from it, though? Because you described your atheism as an inheritance, which I mm-hmm. understand, but is it now something that you have embraced for yourself based on your own inquiry, belief, and understanding?
Nothing has ever happened to make me want to believe in the predominant God. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Or polytheistic deities or anything. No.
Well, as we said, it is a thriller, so we don't want to give away the ending, but can I induce you to give us a word of wisdom, some understanding that you would want people to take away from your particular journey?
Well, one would be, you know, it's my father. My parents said, keep asking. Keep asking questions. Never be satisfied with the answers you get. Push it further. And don't be afraid of finding out things that don't fit into any established pattern or theory in your brain, in your mind. Be ready to be amazed.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of nearly 24 books. Her latest is titled Living with a Wild God, a Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. She joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Barbara Ehrenreich, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. A conflict in Denmark has animal welfare pitted against religious freedoms. The country has decided that all animals must be stunned before being killed, a move that effectively bans ritual slaughter in its purest form, according to Muslim and Jewish traditions. While some consider this a minor administrative change, it's having an unsettling effect on Denmark's religious minorities, as Sissel Overgaard reports.
For Danes like animal welfare activist Peter Møllerup, this is a pretty straightforward issue.
The Danish legislation tells us that if you want to kill an animal, you should do it as quick and as painless that is possible.
And he says that means an animal should not be conscious when it's killed.
I think that it is much better to help the animal here than to help people that think something.
In reality, no animals have been killed in Denmark without stunning for the last 10 years. Denmark's roughly 8,000 Jews import all kosher meat. The issue's a little more complicated for Denmark's 230,000 Muslims. Many Islamic scholars say stunning, while not ideal, is still halal. But some Muslims, like Samah Hamoudi, who's come to the Islamic Society of Denmark for the evening prayer, aren't so sure.
So now I have decided to buy only from those who import meat, so we can be sure it's slaughtered 100% correctly.
But Hamoudi says even for Muslims who are willing to buy Danish meat, the new rule smacks of intolerance.
We think that we have
We just don't feel we have respect for our choices. It's becoming harder and harder to be a Muslim in Europe in general, you understand? There are limits on what we can and what we can't do.
I think it's mainly, I will not say Islamophobia, but it is a lot of people afraid of different things.
Ben Jonas Essebar is with Danish Halal, a group that advocates for stricter adherence to Islamic law in the meat industry.
The religion itself in Europe doesn't play the big role as it does in other countries. So every time we speak about something that have with religion, it will always be looked at as something from medieval times, and it's something that doesn't have any scientific place in our modern days.
Both Jews and Muslims say ritual slaughter is humane. Even so, Britain's top veterinarian recently suggested his country might do well to follow Denmark's lead, and the possibility that this policy could spread to other countries or other traditions is Essebar's biggest fear.
Now they have banned the ritual slaughter. The next step they are debating is actually banning the circumcision of boys.
In that ongoing circumcision debate, it's religious rights versus a child's right to self-determination. Finn Schwartz heads the Jewish community in Denmark.
If you abandon circumcision in Denmark, within very short time, there will be no Jews in Denmark. And we can see on Facebook and all other places, people are saying, but then leave.
And yet, even as Schwartz accuses Denmark of meddling in the private lives of its religious minorities, he insists this has more to do with politics than anti-Semitism.
Today, we are in a situation where we are living in a very complex world. But these issues, the circumcision, the slaughtering, it's so easy and everybody can have their own opinion like here.
Perhaps there is one bright spot in all of this for Denmark's Jews and Muslims, captured recently in a single moment on Danish TV. In one of the many debates featuring these two men on the same side of the table, Schwartz reached out to pat Essebar on the back. I totally agree, he said, and it's nice that we can agree on something once in a while. For NPR News, I'm Sissel Overgaard in Denmark.
Social scientists have learned over the years that they can't always trust what people tell them, ask about their behavior, and some people lie, even to themselves. You have to compare what people say to some measurement of what they actually do. That's what researchers did when looking at religious behavior in three parts of the Muslim world. Our colleague Steve Inskeep discussed this with NPR's Shankar Vedantam.
Okay, so what places are we talking about here?
We're talking about Pakistan, Palestine, and Turkey. Okay. These are very different places, as you know from your own reporting in Pakistan, Steve. Turkey is the most European, and Pakistan is widely seen as the most religious. And the research comes to us via Philip Brenner. He's a sociologist at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He's conducted several studies that explore this contrast between what people say about themselves and their actual behavior. One technique he uses is to track what people tell their diaries. It turns out if you ask people how often they exercise, for example, they'll tell you they exercise very often. But when you look at their diaries, people tell their diaries they exercise far less often than they tell pollsters. And it's the diary entries that match how often their gym membership cards get swiped.
Now, here we're talking about religious behavior. What exactly was being measured in these three different places?
What he finds in these three different places is that people tend to be reporting that they pray more than they actually do. And this finding is very similar to the finding that Brenner made a couple of years ago when it comes to church attendance in the United States. And people in the United States say they go to church, but large numbers actually don't. And what's interesting is in both places, the people who are overreporting their religious behavior have something in common. Here's Brenner.
The similarity between these two places is that it is the people who think that religion is important. It's important in their daily lives. Those are the people who are overreporting. And those are the people who are overreporting church attendance in the U.S. And those are the people who are overreporting prayer in Turkey, Palestine, and Pakistan.
So we're talking about people who are effectively, if you ask how many times a week do you go to church or how many times a day does a Muslim pray, they're supposed to pray five times. The person will report their values or their aspirations. That's what they're saying. They're saying, I wish I prayed five times a day.
That's exactly right, Stephen. It's very insightful because that's exactly what Brenner's saying. He isn't interested in these discrepancies between self-reported behavior and actual behavior just to say, nah, 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 we caught you lying. He thinks that if we look at these discrepancies with curiosity rather than judgment, they can actually tell us something really interesting about these people. Here he is again.
These aren't really mistakes. They're motivated by something. And if we accept these errors as opportunities for understanding, in essence, these respondents are telling us about themselves. They're telling us about what they value, or perhaps who they want to be, or who they think others want them to be.
Okay, so let's take the opportunity he's describing, Shankar. You've got studies of different people in different places, some Christian, some Muslim, and in every case you find certain types of people who are over-reporting their religious behavior. What can we learn from that?
Well, the simple thing we can say, Steve, is that maybe it's expected of people in Pakistan, Turkey, and Palestine, and in parts of the United States, it's expected of you to be very religious, to pray very often, and so people are reporting it because that's just the social norm. Brenner thinks something interesting is going on here below the surface, and he points to the fact that in Pakistan, there is more overreporting than in Turkey. And Turkey is the most European of these three countries, and this mirrors a larger pattern where we see much more overreporting of religious behavior in the United States and far less in Europe. Brenner thinks what's happening in the United States and in these Muslim places is that there might be growing unease with secularization, that when people look out at their societies, they're uneasy with the fact not just that societies are becoming more secular than they were before, but they themselves might be becoming more secular than they used to be.
Turkey is a place that has formally secularized for quite some time, and so a lot of the population seems comfortable with that. Pakistan is going through more convulsions and questioning of what the role of religion in society is, so you're suggesting that in Pakistan people are a little anxious, and that gets reflected in their overreporting of their religion.
Brenner's asking, when do you tend to overreport something? You overreport it when you're anxious about wanting to appear a certain way when you really are not.
Shankar, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's social science correspondent, Shankar Vedantam. You can follow him on Twitter at Hidden Brain. Follow this program, as always, at Morning Edition, at NPR Inskeep, and at NPR Green.
Pentecostalism came to life in the early 1900s here in the U.S. It has since spread around the world faster than any other Christian denomination. Sub-Saharan Africa is now home to nearly 45% of all Pentecostals. Yesterday on our program, we heard how the church's practices have drawn the attention of authorities in Cameroon. Last year, the government of that predominantly Christian country started closing down many Pentecostal churches it saw as a threat to society. Andres Caballero has the story.
I'm in a taxi crossing Douala, Cameroon's largest city. The saying here goes, you can't drive for more than 100 yards without coming across a revival church, a new church. And when you can't see them, you can probably hear them.
I say the mentality of poverty must be removed in Jesus' name. They are
Ministry Faith Banner sits near a busy corner. It's Sunday morning, and the sound from the church's loudspeakers clash with that of passing moto taxis. Dozens of worshippers stand under a blue overflow tent that extends all the way to the sidewalk. Inside the main room, Pastor George Ford Asongu, who's blind, wipes the sweat from his forehead with a white towel and delivers the message. People worship while a group of children take naps near the fans. But this could be the last Sunday service.
In a week's time from today, the government will close me down. So it's actually a very, very terrible news because I've existed for 10 years today.
There are an estimated 500 Pentecostal churches in Cameroon. But in the last year, the government has closed nearly 100 of them in three major cities. Most of these churches were not legally registered and were deemed a threat to society.
They say we pray too much, we disturb, we are breaking down marriages, we are destroying homes, we are exploiting people, which is not true. Even if there are churches that do that, it's not me, because I know what call God has given me for this nation.
Police officers did visit his church, but they seemed interested mostly in shaking him down. One of them asked Pastor Asongu for 100,000 Central African francs. That's about $200, which he didn't have. He says he managed to give him something as a token of appreciation. But apparently, it wasn't enough.
He wasn't happy. He was not pleased with the amount I gave him to appreciate him because I was trying to avoid involving myself in bribery and corruption.
They took the money and said they were going to close the church anyway, citing Asongu's blindness.
Just because the policeman wrote that I'm blind, I'm not qualified to be a pastor?
Like most Pentecostal churches in Cameroon, Asongu's has been operating without legal permission under the government's lax regulations. The only person who can approve a church in Cameroon is the president, Paul Biya. But no church has been officially recognized since 2009. And in the meantime, churches keep sprouting. Last year, Biya's government ordered the crackdown on Pentecostal churches it claimed were criminal enterprises taking advantage of poor, desperate people.
C'est des églises aujourd'hui qui extorquent des fonds.
Minister of Communication Issa Bakari says these churches rip people off and take money from their disciples. He says they disturb neighbors with loud services day and night, and that the government decided to close them wherever their presence becomes harmful enough to endanger society. So the government set up a commission to review the Pentecostal churches and identify those to close. The head of this commission is himself a Pentecostal, Reverend Ludovic Paulin-Fotso.
Certaines églises croiraient plutôt que nous sommes des gendarmes contre eux.
Reverend Fotso says that being between the state and the targeted churches is a sensitive task. Some fellow pastors look at him as if he were the police coming after them. But what he's actually trying to do is clean up and reestablish the church's leadership. And the commission has fueled suspicion. Reverend Patrice Metote is a Pentecostal working to create better training methods for pastors who want to start a church.
Most of our pastors, they are not educated. Some have never been in the Bible school, you see.
He says the commission is the government's way of dividing the church.
Oh, you see all this persecution you are facing. It's your pastor, your friend pastor, who come and give information against you. This is what they are saying. I say, I never believe that till I see.
It's been over a week since Pastor Asongu's church was supposed to be locked by military police. But instead, he sits on a chair and plays the bass with the band. This service feels more like a gospel makosa party. Instead of locking his building, the government asked him for more documents. The registration process is known to take decades, and even though his church is still open today, its future remains uncertain. For NPR News, I'm Andres Caballero.
Andres Caballero is an NPR Above the Fray Fellow, sponsored by the John Alexander Project. That's a group supporting young journalists to find stories like the one we just heard.